All of you true crime fanatics listening will already be very familiar with the 2015 groundbreaking HBO series, The Jinx. And if you're like me, you probably didn't think The Jinx could get any more captivating, but here we are, announcing part two. The first season of The Jinx unraveled one of the most notorious unsolved crimes in New York's history, exposing long-buried information discovered during the filmmaker's decades-long investigation into Robert Durst, scion of New York's billionaire real estate family. So now, with part two, I didn't realize this, but the filmmakers continued investigating for 8 more years, uncovering hidden material, Durst's prison phone calls, and interviews with people who had never come forward before. You can listen to the companion podcast from HBO, which is hosted by executive producer Zach Stewart Pontier, and begins with an episode-by-episode look back of part one, featuring never-before-heard audio between Durst and Jarecki, along with insights from the series creators. Then the podcast will cover The Jinx part two as the series releases on Max. Listen now to the episode that covers the very first episode of The Jinx Part 2, and make sure to watch The Jinx Part 2 on Max, and follow the official Jinx podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
I am at the JW first call of the morning, the JW Marriott Hotel in New Orleans.
This is a voicemail that Bob Durst left for a friend in March 2015. It was between when episodes 5 and 6 of The Jinx first aired, and Bob was on the run. The alias he was using was Everett Ward.
I'm in room 2303 under the name of Ward, W-A-R-D. Room 2303 Ward. Bye-bye.
A few days later, in the lobby of the JW Marriott in New Orleans, Bob Durst was arrested by the FBI. Hi, I'm Zach Stewart Pontier, one of the filmmakers behind HBO's The Jinx. Welcome to the official Jinx podcast, a show where we take you behind the scenes of Andrew Jarecki's documentary series that became a real-life murder investigation. Over the last 7 episodes, we've covered The Jinx Part 1, from never-before-heard conversations with Robert Durst to the shocking discovery of that bathroom audio. And now, we're moving into Part 2. Chapter 7, Why Are You Still Here, was just released on Max, and Andrew and I got into the studio to reflect on the journey of making this season. Andrew, how are you feeling?
I feel good. I think, what a trip. It's been a long trip. It's been a long journey.
Yeah.
I was talking to somebody this morning, and they said, so how long have you been doing this? And I thought, it's actually been since around 2003.
Right.
So now it's 2024. That would be around 21 years.
Starting with his research for his feature film, All Good Things, and then over the course of making The Jinx, Andrew and Bob Durst got to know each other very well.
We had a friendship of sorts. It was not a traditional friendship. It was not something that either one of us expected, but we were thrown together in this weird way. And then we spent a lot of time together and talked and had a lot of conversations.
Another person who was talking to Bob in 2015 when The Jinx was first airing was New York Times reporter Charles Bagley.
The Jinx started airing in February. As each episode aired, Bob was watching from his home in Houston, and he and I spoke after every episode. By the third episode, he was thinking, I'm in pretty good shape. He's covered Galveston, Los Angeles, Westchester. What else can he put in those final episodes?
And then came episode 5.
When I called him after the 5th episode, there was a change in Bob. He was clearly now worried. No, I'm sort of busy right now. Let me get back to you. Say Wednesday. Bye-bye. And I thought to myself, holy shit, he's going to run.
Episode 5 is the one which revealed the letter Bob wrote to Susan Berman. The handwriting on this letter matched the cadaver note sent to LA police after Susan's murder.
I think Bob is figuring out that starting with episode 4, maybe we're not friends anymore. And then episode 5, we're definitely not friends.
Bob watched this and decided to flee his Houston home. That's covered in chapter 7 of the TV show. What's not in the show is that Andrew got word that Bob was on the run through the FBI.
I said to them, I think there's a risk to me, and I'm okay with that, but I'd like to have a plan in place if anything weird happens. And then I remember calling up my guy and having him say, yeah, we really have no idea where he is. And I said, well, how's that possible? You're the FBI, right? You're the Federal Bureau of Investigation. You should be the boss of where people are, especially if they're putting witnesses at risk or whatever. And he said, well, you know, I will keep you posted if we notice anything. So that was not confidence inspiring.
As a precaution, Andrew hired security to protect him and his family.
And then, you know, I'd had this conversation with my daughter where she was quite young at the time. Maybe she was 11. And I remember saying sort of nonchalantly, hey, Jeremy, tomorrow morning when I take you to school, we're going to have a couple of other guys, you know, helping me take you to school. And she immediately started crying. And I thought, all right, well, she gets it. Maybe I should take this seriously.
Around this time, LAPD detectives were at Bob's apartment in Houston trying to piece together his movements. Here's a police interview that wasn't featured in the show with a woman named Cynthia Harris, who worked at the building. She's a little nervous.
I sense a little nervousness on your part. Don't worry. It's not a big deal. You really are not. You're just a... It's not a big deal.
Okay.
You really know nothing about the crimes of Robert Durst.
No, I
don't. Worry about it.
Okay?
Just be very comfortable with that, okay?
Okay.
One of the detectives asked if Bob was acting strange at all.
Did you see him acting strange at all, Mr. Durst?
He always acts strange.
A stranger.
Stranger than usual.
Maybe talking to himself, pacing.
Oh, he does it all the time, too.
Okay.
He talks to himself. Sometimes he may come down the stairs and he may not say anything to you. One day he might come out singing.
Viewers of The Jinx know that Bob has a habit of talking to himself, but Cynthia, she didn't watch it.
You watch that HBO series at all?
I'll be at church on Sunday night, so I never, it come on Sunday night, I've never seen any of them.
She did tell detectives that on the last day she saw Bob, she tried to help him bring some suitcases out to his car.
I tried to help him. I said, okay, and he go, no, I got it, Cynthia. So he put it in the back of the trunk.
And then what happens?
And then after that, that was the end of me seeing it.
Bob never came back to his apartment in Houston. He got into a rental car, turned off his cell phone, and disappeared.
When it came time to track him, I was brought in to help with the technical side of that, where we were able to get up on his cell phone. We got his cell phone records. LAPD was able to obtain a wiretap.
Special Agent Eric Perry of the FBI was listening in on that LAPD wiretap of Bob's cell phone.
I'm sitting there listening to the wiretap Saturday before the last episode, The Jinx, aired, and I hear a phone call come into Bob's cell phone.
Hello. You've reached the Jitterbug voicemail for Bob.
And I could hear Bob trying to log in to his voicemail using his PIN number, and he was unsuccessful. He was actually getting frustrated.
Shit.
So I knew it was Bob.
Agent Perry was able to trace the call to the Marriott Hotel in New Orleans, where Bob had checked in under the name Everett Ward. It's around this time when Bob made that call to his friend we heard at the top of the episode. And, as Andrew explains, Everett Ward was actually someone from Bob's past.
The name Everett Ward came to Bob because he remembered it as the name of another guy who had bought a bow saw at Chalmers Hardware. There had been two bow saws bought around that time. One is the one that Bob bought in order to use it to dismember Morris Black, and the other one was a bow saw bought by a guy named Everett Ward.
In New Orleans, the FBI agents didn't know to check for Everett Ward, so they staked out the lobby of the Marriott Hotel, waiting to arrest Robert Durst. Hours later, Bob walked in. Here's New York Times reporter Charles Bagley again.
One of the FBI agents said, Robert Durst, and Bob kind of stopped, so they started talking to him. And then a woman is walking by, a guest in the hotel, and she said, oh, is that Bob Durst? She had just been watching The Jinx, so she recognized him.
I was contacted and I was told, okay, he's been arrested. The FBI agents asked Bob if he had any ID. So he took them up to his room.
Here's LA prosecutor John Lewin talking about what was found in Bob's hotel room.
They find drugs, a bunch of money, a loaded firearm, and a map of Cuba. There was also a very expensive latex mask.
Did you ever have an opinion about what the mask was going to be for?
Do I have an opinion? The mask was going to be used to disguise himself to flee the country. What I believe. It was not Halloween.
Back in the studio, Andrew reflected on Bob's arrest.
I remember reading that after the arrest, and if I remember correctly, it said, you know, that he was found with a few possessions, including a map of Cuba, and then they just threw in as sort of an add-on, a lifelike, flesh-colored mask. And I remember thinking, well, that doesn't sound like Bob, or that sounds so implausible. But, of course, it was true.
It was very true. I personally had a massive amount of curiosity about this mask and what it looked like. And eventually, Andrew and I got to see it in person in the LAPD evidence room.
Andrew, meet Everett Ward.
I mean, the hair is really good. It's very heavy. I mean, it's a lot thicker than I thought it was going to be.
Because when you look at it, you don't know what it's, you know, it just looks like a heap of rubber until you start seeing the features. And then it gets very spooky. And also the way it lies on the table, a part of the face automatically falls in, so it sort of collapses. So yeah. It really looks like a horror movie mask. And I thought, well, we definitely want to capture that.
Yeah. And then on the flip side was a stamp of the person who made it.
So curious about who makes this thing.
Yeah, can we get a shot of that?
Yeah.
You can like zoom in on the...
I remember that. So that's how we figured it out.
That's how we figured it out.
I didn't remember that. That's amazing.
So it was because we went to look at the real mask that we found out who it was. And then we called and we were still trying to be pretty, like, we didn't know, like, how much the guy would know or not know. He said, oh, well, yeah, I can make that mask for you. No problem. That was used in a check cashing robbery, right? And we were like, something like that. So we ordered the exact same mask to use in our recreation shoots, and when it finally arrived, we all got a deeper understanding of just how effective this disguise could have been.
When we put on the mask, which we all did when we were doing the recreations, it was really spooky because you could put a hat on and you could walk around, and I think the crew would not necessarily know that that was a person wearing a mask. You know, if you get right up close to it, you would say that face is moving weirdly, but it was quite scary to see that you could just see somebody walking through Grand Central wearing a mask like that, and you probably wouldn't notice it.
In the end, the mask didn't work. Bob was arrested, and prosecutor John Lewin flew down to New Orleans to interview him.
Are you cold? Can we get you something? Do you want any drinks, some coffee?
Coffee would be great.
In this next clip, not included in the show, Lewin asked Bob about the money he was arrested with. Over $40,000 in cash.
Well, you've been taking all kinds of money out.
I've been always withdrawing cash.
Right.
I use cash instead of credit cards.
Oh, no.
And also, I mean, cash is what I could buy things for. I mean, I was arrested with a revolver.
Yes.
Well, I couldn't walk into a gun store and buy a revolver, obviously.
Lewin wanted to know who Bob got the gun from, but Bob wasn't telling.
A guy.
Oh, a guy. Okay. So you know how to find a gun that's not traceable.
We're inmates, so people on the street trust me.
Right.
And I trust them.
Lewin tells Bob that he's seen the interviews Bob did with Andrew, and Lewin knows them well, at times even quoting them back to Bob.
This is what he said. Who knew that the police would do oodles of investigation and I would look for motive and I wasn't used to somebody questioning my veracity. Do you remember saying that?
Yeah.
Hey, so do I do a pretty decent you? Pretty good?
Yeah.
Then Bob made some interesting claims about his state of mind during filming.
For the whole long weekend when I did the interviews for the Jinx,
yeah,
I was on meth. The whole time I was on meth. Surprised my lawyer let me go ahead with it because it just, I looked like there was something going on.
Bob says the thing about that he was on meth, which when I read that, I thought, oh my God, it's incredible that Bob went for that. Like I was on, yeah, I was really on drugs. Then Lewin's like, that's not going to work.
You would prefer that I be a straight shooter and not a bullshitter, right?
Sure.
Okay, I'm a straight shooter. What you just told me is bullshit.
I mean, I think Bob likes drugs, but I don't think he's on meth.
And now we get to what New York Times reporter Charles Bagley called a conversation that sounds almost like a plea bargain. Bob brings up telling Lewin some stuff that would make Ann McCormick, his missing wife Kathy's mom, happy.
Well, you asked me what I thought you wanted to hear. I think what you wanted to hear to make Ann McCormick happy is, what did you do with Kathy?
Right.
And I think you want me to go through details of Susan.
I do.
Okay, so now, what would I ask for?
Tell me.
If I tell you those things, I'm pleading guilty.
From Lewin's point of view, things looked like they were falling into place.
I felt at the end of that interview that I was 10 minutes away from a confession.
Eventually, Lewin realized that Bob wasn't going there.
It wasn't that I was so great getting down to the 5-yard line. It's that he really wasn't playing any defense, and he's not going to let me get into the end zone.
Bob went to court and didn't speak to Lewin again until the trial. Meanwhile, Andrew was thinking about visiting Bob. Bob's arrested in New Orleans, and you find yourself in New Orleans, right?
Yeah. It bothered me that I had not talked to Bob after the arrest.
All right, so we're heading out of the French Quarter right now and going to visit Bob at the St. Charles Parish Jail. I'm hearing that the place that Bob is incarcerated is in the middle of nowhere.
I felt like if Bob wanted to tell any more of his story, he was going to tell it to me, right? I mean, maybe he would call up some other TV journalist and say, oh, well, you know, that guy got it wrong. But we did have a shorthand, and I did think that there was a pretty good chance that he was going to plead guilty. And I thought, well, if he wants to unburden himself or something, I have a responsibility to be there. It'll be fascinating to be there. I just want to hear what he has to say at this point.
Andrew wrote a letter to Bob, and he read it on the way out to visit him.
Dear Bob, if you're reading this, it's likely they didn't allow me to visit you today when I came to the jail. As you are likely aware, your fame is quite widespread now. The Bob Durst phenomenon has become a real cultural touchstone.
So when I got out there, it was this kind of sad slab in the middle of nowhere, kind of in the bayou. And it was really like surrounded by ponds and, you know, Lake Pontchartrain. And there's like a irrigation pond in front of the jail that's got actual alligators in it. So the whole thing was very dramatic and weird.
Can I help you with something?
I'm waiting for Mr. Durst.
Mr. Durst?
I came to visit him.
All right, go step into visitation and they'll take care of you in there, sir.
Okay.
And I say to this lady behind the visitor counter, I said, I'm here to see Bob Durst. And I knew I was there right on time and that was his window. He had like an hour a week when he was allowed to see visitors. And she looks at me and she says, he's out. Which is not what you want to hear. And I said, wait, they're allowed to just go out? Can you explain this to me? And she goes, well, I shouldn't say this, but, you know, he's at an appointment. So then I thought, oh, he must be at a medical appointment. I said, well, can I wait? And she said, yeah. But if he comes, you know, unless he comes back soon, you know, you're going to miss your window.
And I said, all right. So I remember going out and sitting on the bench outside. And within about 5 seconds, a van pulls up. And it's a corrections department van. And it pulls into the Sally Port. And the two kind of chain link gates close on either side of it. I'm standing in like the bright sunlight. And I see in the shadow, these two corrections officers get out. They open the double doors at the back of the van. And I see shuffling out in leg irons and handcuffs, Bob Durst. And I felt a little sad for him in that moment. And so Bob walks through the Sally Port and I look at him and he looks at me and I look at him and he's sort of in the shadow and I'm in the bright sunlight. And he didn't say anything. And then he just kind of resumed his trudge into the jail. So then I went back in and I said to the woman, well, he's back. And so can you ask him if he'll see me?
They gave him your name and told him that they're going to bring him back to the pod to visit. And he asked, who? And when they gave him, because that's why I had to spell your name.
I got you. And then what did he say?
He declined the visit.
I wasn't surprised when she said that, but it was a little bit sad just because I thought there was a good chance that in that moment, Bob might just say, well, I'm super bored here. This is a terrible place for me to be. And this guy had a lot to do with getting me here. Maybe I'll see what he has to say for himself, which is kind of what I had put in the letter. Right. But anyway, I didn't end up seeing him. But I do feel like I had to kind of close the loop with him and at least try to see him.
We actually have, through the course of our investigation, uncovered two other people's perspectives on this visit. Do you remember what I'm talking about?
I do. I think Bob talks to Debbie about it.
Yeah.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good. Do you know that you actually came to this prison in a vain attempt to visit?
Yes.
So you know that?
Yes, I know.
But also John Lewin. You get a call from John Lewin.
Andrew, it's John Lewin. I'm shocked by this, but apparently you tried to go down there and do an interview with Bob. To say that this is not helpful to our case would be an understatement. They thought that I had put you up to this, which obviously it's been shown I don't have any control whatsoever over what you do. Please give me a call. We're trying to see justice done here. I think that's something you care about. This is really putting us in a very bad position. Please call me. Thank you.
You know, John was furious that I had gone to see Bob. He was just like, what are you doing mucking around in my situation? And I said, well, you told me that you don't control me, and you know you don't control me.
Andrew says this angry message from Lewin underscored one of the most complicated aspects of making the jinx.
But it's always been this balance, right? It's like, on the one hand, we had this dual role, right? Because as filmmakers, our job was to make a really cogent, honest story about what happened and try to give the audience a feeling of something that they would never have seen before, to really look into the mind of a person like Bob.
And later on, we got to hear more of Bob talking about this visit. Here he is in a call with his friend, Susie Giordano.
In my brief meeting, and it was very brief, and we were never closer than like 50 feet because they wouldn't let him get close to where the entrance was, his attitude to me seemed smart alecky.
I think cocky is more his attitude. He's very cocky, but I think he thought you would be glad to see him in this psychotic way.
We come at it from two different directions. My direction is, here is this smart alecky guy saying, you know, I really fucked you.
I think he's a weird individual.
Or he could go to jail, very possibly. causing me to die in jail, and I'm supposed to want to talk to him about it?
I think he's crazy. I do. I think he has a lot of guilt. I think he has a lot of guilt.
Yeah, I can see it being guilt for him. The Jarecki stuff makes me feel like a deer or a rabbit that's being hunted, but it doesn't know that it's being hunted, and it's helping the hunters.
I imagine that was a very emotional feeling. You know, he says that when he thinks about the jinx, he realizes that he didn't understand what was happening. He didn't understand the jeopardy that he was putting himself in because he doesn't know he's being hunted. And that's a very kind of chilling concept.
At times, Bob may have pitied himself for being a victim, but he also used his vulnerabilities to his advantage. Someone who saw this firsthand but wasn't included in the TV show is Detective Liz Camacho.
I don't think he was as feeble as he wanted people to think at that point.
She accompanied Bob on his flight back to L.A.
He would sort of be looking very ill and infirmed, and then when I would look over, I would catch him kind of looking and surveying the surrounding. Like, he was much more aware of and trying to survey his surroundings and who was on the plane than he let on to be.
When they touched down in Los Angeles, the airport was swarming with law enforcement.
LAPD has an actual hangar, and all of our SWAT guys are there on the runway waiting for him, and he steps off the plane, and here he is, this old, feeble guy, and it was priceless to see our best of the best tactic guys, our SWAT guys, kind of look like, this is who we're protecting.
They put Bob in a van and drove him to the jail. From where the van was parked, the door to the jail was about 100 feet away, and Bob was going to have to walk.
And so we got him out of the car, and the other team got out of their car, and they're in the back, and we're in the front, and Bob's in the middle. And Bob had been walking, you know, behind us and sort of doing his Bob shuffle.
Detective Camacho says that Bob was shuffling slowly toward the door. When they got there, it was locked. That meant an even longer walk to the next entrance.
And when he realized that it was going to be another 50 feet, he kind of went, and he just started walking normally. He got tired of the charade, so he's like, fuck it. And he kept walking. It was pretty funny.
You felt like there was more going on.
Yes, definitely. Definitely more going on than he let up, I guess.
Next time on the Official Jinx podcast, we'll dive into Chapter 8 and we'll learn about some of the key members of Bob's inner circle, including Nick Chavin, Bob's best friend, who tried to make it as an unconventional musician.
Were you trying to send a message? Were you trying to...
Yes. Let's eat, fuck, and play the violin, because tomorrow we'll all be nitrogen. I'd say that was the message. No, the message was I want to get rich.
The Official Jinx podcast is hosted by me, Zach Stewart-Pontier. It's produced by ZSP Media and Hit the Ground Running Films with HBO. Watch episodes of The Jinx and stream The Jinx Part 2, now on Max. This episode was produced by Ethan Oberman and Naomi Brauner. The rest of our team is Laura Newcomb and Ramoy Phillip. The supervising producer is Liz Stiles. This episode was edited by Simone Palanin. Mixing and engineering by Sam Baer. It was recorded at Relic Room in New York City. Music by Wes Dylan Thordson. Additional music courtesy of HBO. The executive producers are Andrew Jarecki and me, Zach Stewart-Pontier. Special thanks to Michael Gluckstadt, Ali Cohen, Aaron Kelly, and Savon Slater at HBO Podcasts. And the fabulous Jinx team, Sam Neve, Kyle Martin, Charlotte Kaufman, Richard Henkin, Susan Lazarus, Annabelle White, Pedro Vital, Jesse Herman, Michele Zabarfian, and Nako Narder. And thanks to Roe Dillon, George Vogel, Charlie Wessler, Nancy Jarecki, and Emily Wiedemann. And thank you so much for listening and making it all the way through the credits. Here's a little more of that interrogation between Bob and John Lewin.
I would love for Ryan Gosling to play me in a movie because he's a really good-looking guy. Did a part of you go,
That's pretty cool having a guy that good looking play me. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. In my movie, I would get John Lovitz, or I would get Jonah Hill.